what is really going on through the world. Under the awakening, that leads to peace and love.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It's Remembrance Sunday, but what are we remembering? Is it the disastrous invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan? Yes, it's Remembrance Sunday this weekend, and with the fallen of so many different conflicts, what exactly now is Poppy Day all about? We speak to one soldier who's worried about increasing sponsorship of Poppy Day by the arms industry. And tomorrow, Bristol takes on TTIP, that is, to you and I, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. This is a trade deal which threatens to make voting totally pointless across the Western world. We hear all about it from Mike Birkin at Southwest Friends of the Earth. Plus, the maker of the Lockerbie film that we featured last week, that's called The Maltese Double Cross, all about the Lockerbie crash in 1988. What did Alan Frankovich make after three decades of making films all about the CIA? Plus, Martin takes us to the South China Sea, maybe, on his tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week with the former soldier, was in the SAS, Ben Griffin from Veterans for Peace. Hi, Ben, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
First of all, Ben, I was quite shocked to hear that some of the Poppy Day events are actually being taking money from people who are in the arms industry. Can you just tell us a bit about that? Which events and which companies in the arms world?
Well, so the Royal British Legion probably collects about £135 million a year. Now, if you think about the average cost of a poppy or the average price of a poppy, most people give a pound or maybe £2. Now, even if 40 million people bought a poppy, that's only 40 million quid. So you've got to ask the question, where's the rest of the money coming from? And we know where it's coming from. It's coming from British Aerospace, Tarley's, Lockheed Martin, huge arms companies who are funding the British Legion.
Okay. Just tell us, first of all, British Aerospace? I know we have actually got an office of British Aerospace here in Bristol. I mean, what's the problem with these people? Yes, they're making money from arms, but if they weren't doing it, we'd have to buy those arms from somewhere else, wouldn't we?
Well, it's not just about us buying arms. It's the arms that are sent around the world creating chaos and havoc in other countries. Britain and America and Sweden and Israel are responsible for huge numbers of weapons out there in the world that only increase the violence out there.
But I mean, surely the weapons are used in a war which is decided normally by politicians who are elected by us. So there are always going to be wars, surely.
Well, I think you can see from the two wars that we've just fought, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, in fact we're back in Iraq now, the reason we fight these wars are never the reasons that we're given, and we're not actually very successful at fighting them. So this whole argument that we must always have war kind of falls to pieces in the modern context.
Okay, tell us what you can. I imagine you can't say everything about what you did when you were a soldier and why you decided to get involved in this, forming this Veterans for Peace organisation.
Well, I was involved in activity out in Iraq that I considered to be illegal and definitely immoral. And I left the army as a result of that. And I was working on my own for many years, speaking out against the war. And I came to realise that actually there were a lot of other veterans who felt the same as me, felt that they'd been involved in wars that were immoral and irrational, and that this wasn't the way for the world and for the UK to solve its problems. So we got together in 2011 and formed an organisation in this country called Veterans for Peace. We're based on an organisation, a similar organisation that was formed in 1985 in America. And we've got veterans ranging all the way back to the D-Day landings, through most of the post-colonial conflicts, all the way up to Iraq and Afghanistan today.
Now, your criticism of Poppy Day, I mean, for some people, this will be rather horrifying. I mean, there is also this group There's also, I mean, other sort of competing groups for veterans who might want their money. For example, Help for Heroes. And if you're saying you shouldn't maybe be sponsoring or be part of these things which are sponsored by the arms industry, what are you saying about the poppy? Should we not be wearing them?
No, that's what you said, Tony. And there's already confusion around this, and a part of this confusion is a result of the campaign waged by the Royal British Legion. Poppy Day is a made-up day, usually a week or two before Armistice Day, in which the Royal British Legion hits the streets in all sorts of cities trying to sell poppies. Remembrance Sunday is the closest Sunday to Armistice Day, at which the state holds its official ceremony of remembrance. And Armistice Day is the 11th of November to remember the day that this First World War finished. So let's try and clear up this confusion, all these different terms about what things are and what things aren't. Now, we're not telling people not to buy red poppies. We're not telling people to buy white poppies. What we're saying is that we think the campaign that is waged by the Royal British Legion has little to do with remembrance. You only need to look in Covent Garden this week, where their Poppy Day consisted of men in poppy outfits, you know, like football mascots dancing around. Very little to do with remembering the First World War, the Second World War, or any other conflict, and all to do with glossing over these conflicts and running a campaign that promotes unquestioning support for the military and war.
Okay, one of the problems for even, you know, people who are quite supportive of the Legion and buy poppies and supportive of everything the Legion do is that there seems to be a bit of a difference between the more modern wars that we've been having, Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, do you think that there was anything really positive about those? Because some people will say, Ben, that Iraq, for example, we got rid of Saddam, who was a tyrant, and in Afghanistan, you know, that women's rights have been brought forward decades.
Now, you and I, Tony, know that those weren't the reasons that we went to those wars. So the reason we went to war in Iraq was to find weapons of mass destruction, of which we found zero. Now, the problem with the war in Iraq was, and you can see the outcomes of it now, is the unforeseen consequences of any military action. And what we're seeing now play out in the Middle East is a result of our invasion of Iraq in 2003. The conflict in Syria, the rise of ISIS, you know, and a whole load of other problems that are brewing up all over the Middle East. And every time we get involved, we make things worse. You know, it was only a few years ago that we were in Libya to liberate that country from Gaddafi. And if we look at that country now, it's been taken over by Islamists. It's not safe for anyone in that country. So I'd be cautious about extolling the virtues of British military action and our successes.
Interesting you mentioned Libya, because it's been in the news this week. There's been a whole load of Libyan troops being trained over in Cambridge who've been unruly and accused of sexual assaults. So let's go back to Wednesday this week, to the House of Commons, to Prime Minister's Questions, where Andrew Lansley, the local MP there, brought up a question for David Cameron, Ben, if you can bear with us.
Andrew Lansley.
Mr. Speaker, my right honourable friend will recall our support for the training of Libyan troops at Bassingbourne Barracks in my constituency of South Cambridgeshire. Does he share my concern that the programme failed to maintain discipline and the consequences of that were very serious in my local community? Will he undertake the Ministry of Defence will give my constituents a full accounting for the failures in the delivery of this programme? Will he also agree that the Libyan soldiers should now be repatriated to Libya and there is no basis for any of them to seek or receive asylum in this country?
No, well, I agree with my right honourable friend on every front. What has happened at Bassingbourne in Cambridgeshire is completely unacceptable. These are criminal actions, and I've asked the Chief of the Defence Staff for a report into this. A decision was taken at the National Security Council, which I chaired, on the 28th of October, to end this training altogether. The trainees will be returning to Libya in the coming days, and in the meantime, all unescorted visits from the camp have been stopped altogether.
Well, that was an excerpt from Prime Minister's Questions earlier this week. Andrew Lansley, South Cambridgeshire Conservative MP, asking David Cameron about it. Joining me on the line is Ben Griffin from Veterans for Peace. I just wonder what your thoughts are, Ben, on this kind of thing, because we're hearing that the Libyan troops have now been flown back. Also, that there was no explanation for these troops of the difference between right and wrong as they were being trained.
Well, I think we need to look at the bigger picture here. The British population, the population within the United Kingdom, is insulated from these wars, insulated from the wars that we start, that we cause, and that we make worse. So if we look at Libya, if we look at Iraq and look at Afghanistan, the people in those countries have been murdered, tortured, killed, had their homes destroyed. And this actions of these Libyan troops, in a small way, that's the war coming home to us. Basically, we're insulated from these things. These soldiers, who knows where they came from? Who knows what their background was? Probably been brutalized and traumatized by the conflict that they've been involved in. Whoever's idea it was to bring them over here, you know, we haven't got to the bottom of that yet, have we?
No, we certainly haven't. And I just wondered what your thoughts are about the whole sort of, because I mean, what we keep being told, and this may be true and it may be not, I'd like to hear your view, that these kinds of wars are necessary largely because we need to keep on the case to stop Islamist terror groups.
Well, the CIA admitted this well over a decade ago, that it is our own actions that ferment and accentuate or build these Islamist movements. Our invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya only fuel this Islamist fire. And it's a crazy situation, because everything we do pretty much makes things worse. But this whole idea that we're either out in Afghanistan or out in Iraq now, back in Iraq, to stop the Islamist threat from reaching the shores of Britain is nonsense. These people are interested in taking control of their own countries. These sort of ideas that they're going to somehow turn up over here, what, maybe on a boat or in a plane, is far-fetched. In fact, the terrorism that we have experienced in this country has predominantly been carried out by people who grew up here.
Also, there is this real serious problem going on in the Middle East now with ISIS. Surely you're not suggesting that we should just stand by and allow this to happen without intervening?
Look, Tony, you know, every time we intervene, there are unforeseen consequences. And ISIS is one of those unforeseen consequences of us invading Iraq in the first place. Now, if we honestly believe that military action is going to solve this problem, I think we're not looking at the evidence of the last 10 years of war, or the last 14 years of war post 9/11.
Going back to this, the issue we started on, which is Poppy Day and this Remembrance Sunday this weekend, what will you be doing? Will you be wearing your poppy? Will you be going to a remembrance service?
So, Veterans for Peace, we're holding a ceremony at the Cenotaph at 2 p.m. on Sunday afternoon. Our members will be wearing white poppies, red poppies, no poppies. It's a personal choice for us. But we will be carrying a wreath of predominantly white poppies to the Cenotaph to lay there, in recognition that the vast majority of people killed in war, and this goes all the way back to the Second World War, are civilians. We'll be remembering the civilians. We'll also be remembering the enemy dead. Because the official ceremony is quite clear that they only want to remember British and Commonwealth troops who were killed, and we want to broaden that out to all people who were killed in war.
Ben Griffin from Veterans for Peace, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Cheers, Tony.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And before we get off the subject of war, Martin, we've heard this week, although it's not really been reported much in the mainstream press, that there's been a breakdown in the ceasefire in the east of Ukraine and another assault, yeah, or more assaults on civilians by the Ukrainian army in Donetsk.
Yes, I mean, there was hope that we might be moving towards a solution there because of the Minsk agreement. But you've seen that they've had elections now in both the West Ukraine and the East Ukraine. And I'm afraid, obviously, it's very difficult to hold a free and fair election in either part of the country in these circumstances where everything's so polarised. But it's pretty clear that, a bit like Northern Ireland, the West has voted for one way and the East has voted another way. And that shouldn't necessarily lead to further conflict. But I'm afraid, and we're going to come to discuss TTIP in a minute, I'm afraid the Americans in particular are keen to foment this conflict, because they want to shepherd the West Europeans in particular into signing trade deals with the Americans, where in actual fact for Germany, for example, it makes a lot more sense for them to do deals with the Russians.
Now, I mentioned that the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership at the top of the hour. Well, what is the connection then between what's going on in Ukraine and TTIP, and who's behind it? What's actually the terrain in which that whole conflict is operating?
I've been on Russia Today talking about this, as you know, Tony. The shootings in the Maidan Square in February were carried out by snipers, which shot both police officers and liberal protesters. And there was a telephone intercept between Umas Piats and Catherine Ashton, Umas Pitts is the foreign minister of Estonia, speaking to Catherine Ashton, saying, well, the evidence from the hospitals is that this was carried out by groups associated with the new regime, specifically Andrei Paribi and Pravi Sector.
Now, Catherine Ashton being at the time the High Representative,
her response is really interesting. She's the only British person in the
She's an EU person.
She's going, gosh, golly, really? And it's you just think, well, that's how much you know about what NATO gets up to. And the other thing, of course, is the shooting down of the airliner, where the evidence is piling up that was actually shot down by two fighters flying out of Kiev in order to try and blacken the Russians. Now, all of this stuff is coming to a head because the purpose of the conflict in the Ukraine is to make sure that sanctions are placed on the Russians, and the developing relationship between the Germans and the Russians, in particular German industry and Russian industry, is
It seems to be working because the rubles had a terrible week.
Yes, but don't forget, if the Russian economy starts to go down, we're probably going to have a simultaneous crash in China, Russia and the West, because all of these things are totally interlinked. But the purpose of, in my view, the geopolitical purpose behind fomenting trouble in the Ukraine, which is definitely what the Americans were doing. Victoria Nuland was there, definitely stirring the pot. She admitted that they'd spent $5 billion on trying to overthrow the Yanukovych government, is to force the Western Europeans into a basically effectively a not very good deal from the point of view of the Western Europeans with the US is struggling to maintain its global hegemony. And of course, in actual fact, as in the years of peace since the fall of the Berlin Wall, inevitably German and Russian industrialists have been working together as well they might rather than working with
California. Martin, you say struggling, they actually seem to be doing rather well. And if this Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership signed at the end of the year, looks like they'll have got exactly what they wanted.
What, the Americans?
Yes.
No, the Federal Reserve has just stopped printing money.
We were saying earlier, yes, other people are doing it instead. So that keeps the economy going.
What's happening there is a currency war, because the yen is now falling on the international exchanges, which actually completely shafts the South Korean economy. So the South Koreans will have to force down the won. And when they do that, everybody's forcing their currency down. And of course, the Americans sit on top of the whole pile, massively able, because the dollar is needed to buy oil. Everybody's got to have dollars to buy oil, so they can run trade and budget deficits far in excess of what anybody else can dare to do. But ultimately, of course, we're moving towards a world in which the dollar will not be the world's reserve currency. And at that point, the economy of the US will collapse. And it's already in a pretty ropey state. As we saw, the Obama administration did not reap any kind of feel-good factor in the elections this week in the US.
Before we totally leave the idea of war and move on to talk about the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership with Mike
Birkin. These things are linked.
Is there anywhere else around the world you want to bring attention to this week, Martin?
Let me just think what's been going on. I mean, obviously, the Ukraine is still a flashpoint. We've still got the war in Syria, which is spreading into Lebanon. There's a potential. I see that the Leap 2020 website, which is a French think tank, they say that we've now reached the point where the economic crisis and the geopolitical crisis are indistinguishable. It's not just a question of economics or a question of politics and war. All of these things are actually being interacted.
Does that mean
together.
That actually countries and big states are quietly using economic warfare?
Yes, well, don't forget the whole war in Syria is about who is going to build an oil pipeline to take the gas market from the Russians at the minute supply 38% of Western Europeans' natural gas. They're by far the biggest suppliers. There is a potential for natural gas to come either from Iran or from Qatar to replace the Russian natural gas.
So at the moment, it's put on tankers.
There was a plan by Bashar Assad and the Iranians to build an oil pipeline from Iran through Syria to the Mediterranean to provide competition to the Russians. But of course, the Russians were accepting that because they believe that things should be done on, you know, if the pipeline is viable, we'll just have to live with it. There's a South Stream pipeline which is supposed to be coming up through Bulgaria and Austria. The Austrians want to sign a deal for this South Stream going round Ukraine, and the Americans
from Russia.
The Americans are trying to sabotage that. And they've also, of course, the Saudis and the Americans are trying to sabotage the other, what they call the Islamic pipeline from Iran through to the Mediterranean. So the Qataris want to control Syria. They want a Muslim Brotherhood aligned government. The Saudis just want any government that isn't Assad, so that they can then build a pipeline which will then undercut the Russians. But of course, in reality, this winter, Germany in particular is reliant on Ukraine on Russian gas.
So why is it that fossil fuels, natural gas, energy is such a key thing in the modern world, and actually can cause wars?
Well, why did the Wehrmacht drive to the Caucasus in 1942? It's because that's where the oil was. Why were they fighting in North Africa? Because it's the way to Iraq where the rest of the oil was. Why did the British and the Americans overthrow the democratically elected government of Ukraine of Iran in 1954? It's all about oil and gas, and the price of oil is now being forced down by the Saudis and the Americans in order to try and bankrupt the Russians. Unfortunately, as William Engdahl's pointed out, at the same time they're also bankrupting their own fracking industry, because fracking is important. Did you know that in the Donbass,
fracking industry is being bankrupted.
Yeah, but it is being bankrupted by their policy of trying to bankrupt the Russians. So, but don't forget that the government in Kiev cannot accept separatism in the Donbass, because that is where there's a potential oil gas field to be fracked. And of course the Donbass doesn't want any fracking. That's why they're fighting. That's one of the things they're fighting for, is we don't want fracking. You can take it home. We're not having it.
Smiling Michael, come on and tell us about TTIP. This is Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth. I know there's a meeting tomorrow, I believe, in the city, which is really explaining, I suppose, to any of the visitors. It's, I suppose, a sort of campaign meeting, as well as a discussion about what exactly the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership is and what it means for Britain.
It's a cross-party political panel that we've got, and I think what's been interesting about this Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, which henceforward I shall say TTIP just for saving time, is that it's been something that's concern has been growing about it away from headlines. So there's been, you know, if you look at the sort of dominant media coverage over the past couple of months, it hardly figures at all. And yet beneath that, there's been a growing concern about what this partnership might actually mean in terms of lowering standards of environmental protection, or lowering protection for human health or workers' rights, driving us to the lower standards across both sides of the Atlantic. And out of this has grown such a groundswell of concern that we're expecting now, we've got a meeting in the Wills Memorial Hall in the university in Bristol, which has a capacity for 600, and it's looking like it's going to be pretty full. I don't want to discourage people from coming along. The doors are open at 3.
You might have to bring your own fold-up chair.
There will be stalls and a film before the main event, which is the panel discussion, which starts at 4. And we've got 3 of the city's MPs from across the political spectrum. So we've got Stephen Williams, Liberal Democrat from Bristol West. We've got Kerry McCarthy, Labour from Bristol East. And we've got Charlotte Leslie, Conservative from Bristol North West. And we've got our Green MEP, Molly Scott-Cato, who also is an economist and sits on the European Parliament's Economics Committee. So that's our panel of politicians. In addition to that, we have Nigel Costley from Southwest TUC, we have Sam Lowe, who's from Friends of the Earth, and we have Fran Boyd from Positive Money. So we have 3 people to bring a different perspective and expertise about TTIP. So the whole thing goes on from 4 till 6, and say doors are open at 3, but the main panel is from 4 till 6, and you're welcome to come along. Wills Memorial Hall at the top of Park Street.
Now, the thing is, for most of us, we haven't got the time to go into the details. Why is this important? Why?
Okay, I think one of the flashpoints has been the secrecy of the whole deal. That it's been negotiated between politicians or commissioners from the European Commission with their counterparts from Washington, and even European parliamentarians have had no access to this process. They haven't been able to see.
A couple of weeks ago, I saw a video of some MEPs. I mean, this is basically unelected European EU officials doing this deal behind closed doors, and some MEPs actually smashed their way in through a door to find out what it was that was being discussed. Now, I find this amazing.
There's something called the reading room that they couldn't get into.
That our elected officials are not allowed to know what's what's going on. We hear this actually, frighteningly, here in Bristol City Council as well, that some of the councillors are saying, well, actually, we're not allowed to see the basic figures to do with the arena, this kind of thing. So this secrecy is really quite important. So what is being what do we know about what's being decided and behind closed doors?
Well, again, one of the big concerns here about the loss of democratic accountability and secrecy relates to a particular part of the TTIP agreement, which is it's about the resolving disputes between companies and states. And this is something that people are very concerned about because of the precedents that are happening under other agreements around the world, where you've got things like the tobacco company Philip Morris trying to take a legal action against the government of Australia, where the government of Australia wants to impose plain packaging on cigarettes for health reasons. They believe they'll get, you know, a healthier population if cigarette packets aren't dressed up attractively.
But if they pass a law to do that, then no one can stop them, surely.
Well, Philip Morris are trying to sue them through an opaque legal process, and that's what TTIP threatens to enshrine, so that we would have, in effect, private courts which would allow corporations to take governments to court if they saw that a particular piece of legislation or regulation that a government was passing threatened the profitability of their interests.
But isn't that just part of the modern world? Actually, we know, don't we, that the big corporations are far, far wealthier than governments.
Well, there are existing legal processes by which if corporations, I mean, I'm not saying necessarily it's a good thing, but if corporations want to start taking legal action against governments for things that they perceive to be not in their interest, then there are existing legal channels which they can use. And one of the things that's particularly frightening about TTIP is that it sets up an entirely parallel a private process which takes it away from the remove of the existing courts and becomes something that, like the partnership itself, politicians don't have access to. We don't have access to. It's fought out by lawyers representing the states and the companies behind closed doors.
Now, reading in the International Business Times here online that Germany is being accused of hypocrisy because they're opposed to this ISDS clause. I think that's the special clause you're talking about. So the Germans are leading the way against this, it seems, this clause.
Well, good for them if they are, but I mean, whatever, who knows what other motives they may have. I mean, our own government has been one of the cheerleaders for the TTIP within Europe, and so that's I think a particularly good reason why it would be interesting to hear what our MPs, two of them from the coalition parties, have to say about this tomorrow.
Also, I mean, just to reiterate that, the German Economics Minister, Sigmar Gabriel, he told Parliament, the German Parliament, it's completely clear that we reject these investment protection agreements. So it does seem that there is a bit of a wave starting across Europe. It's just a question of, you know, how many... what do you think? Do you think this is all going to be signed and sealed in December? What's your prediction, Mike?
I think it's unlikely. These kinds of agreements don't have a good track record of being signed and sealed on schedule because actually there are so many competing vested interests. It's not just a simple case of a sort of cartel of corporations and a few friendly governments locking themselves in a room and coming up with an agreement that suits them, because actually they too have conflicts of interest within the other side of the closed door, if you like. So there are lots of reasons why this whole process might be delayed and derailed, but fundamentally it comes down to how much power the citizens of Europe can exert on their governments negotiating on their behalf to think again about the TTIP.
Okay, also on another topic, the Hinkley Power Station, Hinkley C, seems to have been approved. What are your thoughts on what's your reaction as an organisation, Friends of the Earth, as to that? Because what we're being told is that we really do need clean energy. That's what they're calling it, clean energy, which doesn't actually contribute to global warming. And that's the key reason why this has been approved.
Yeah, one of the many sad things about Hinkley is that this deal that has now been signed between our government and EDF, although it's not, you know, finally yet, the investment hasn't been secured, it's, you know, still some way away from bulldozers rolling down in Somerset. But what's particularly sad about this deal is it takes so much of the sort of reserves that are required to promote green energy sources, clean energy sources, that it leaves very little for anything else. So already we're seeing investors pulling away from offshore wind farms that have been proposed around the coast of the UK because the money simply isn't there to make it economic for them to do so.
Well,
and that is because the Treasury has imposed a cap on it, and most of it is going to go to Hinkley C. So it's very worrying that what are potentially much more benign energy sources are falling by the wayside and being squeezed out.
Those pretty little windmills are never going to make the amount of power that a giant nuclear power station will.
Well, we're talking about offshore wind installations here that generate thousands of megawatts of power, which actually does compare with nuclear power stations. Obviously, they don't do it in the same way because the wind doesn't always blow at the same speed. But if people are worried about the reliability of renewable energy, let's just look at what's been happening with other forms of energy in the last few weeks. We've had four nuclear power stations taken offline and a big fire at Didcot gas-fired power station. So actually, middle of last month, we were suddenly faced with a massive shortfall of electricity generating, and fortunately the wind turbines were going at the time and kept the lights on.
Now, we've heard scare stories over the last 3 or 4 years over energy. Are they scare stories? Do we really need to be worried that the lights are going to go out?
Right at the moment, no, we don't. There's no sort of real credible scenario other than loads and loads of power stations all coming offline at once. There's no credible scenario that would lead to lights going out over this winter. If you look at the longer term, then more nuclear, although the industry keeps trying to keep nuclear power stations going, nevertheless they are going to get to the end of their life, and there's a lot still to play for in terms of what happens with coal-fired power stations, but some of our coal-fired power stations may be coming offline too. So we may be looking at, over the sort of decade timescale, less capacity than would allow the grid to be operated safely. So there are two questions there. One is, what can you do? What can you be built to replace that capacity? And offshore wind is actually coming up very fast. But also, what could we do to reduce demand? And that could be the best win of all, the quickest win of all.
Oh, this part of the country used to be actually in Somerset particularly, also obviously South Wales, a big coal mining area. Is there actually the technology there to make coal cleaner?
There could be, but it's a long shot. And we wouldn't be able to predict at what cost that might be done. So we're pretty clear that the cost of renewable electricity is dropping dramatically. So it's quite likely that in sunnier parts of Europe and the US within the next year or two, in fact, it may already be the case in California, that you'd be able to generate electricity from solar power more cheaply than you could from gas or coal. And probably the rest of Europe is going to follow suit within a decade. Same with wind power. Onshore wind power is probably going to be cheaper than gas at some point.
I mean, the way it is. You basically just have to look at Germany to see the way things are going, apart from our nuclear power station. But what overall is Friends of the Earth's vision for the future energy use? Because surely, ultimately, we've got to reduce the amount of energy we use. We can't carry on as we are with all these traffic jams, using cars as much as we are, Mike.
Well, there are very good reasons for limiting that profligate use of energy on grounds of our health as much as anything else. You referred to traffic jams. I mean, air quality, air pollution is a problem that's been dogging Bristol for decades, and it shows no sign of getting any better. So we've got very good reasons for reducing our consumption of fossil fuels.
But the government is actually reliant on the duty that they get from selling petrol, so they're not going to give it up, are they? I mean, what about the... I mean, everybody's annoyed, surely. I mean, everyone literally that uses a car is annoyed about the fact that we've seen these plummeting oil prices that Martin was talking about just now, and yet that has not been reflected at all in the petrol pumps,
in the price at the pumps. No, it isn't, and that's
is it a ratchet corporate system? Does it only go up and never down? Like a bit like private rented landlords renting
or train fares
or train fares. Yeah, there's quite a few ratchets around, aren't there? That's not really a free market. So is there any prospect that actually people will there will be some kind of real free market in oil and in in petrol?
No, we're not. We never have had a free market in energy options, and we won't do so for the foreseeable future. So it's a question of how we use the levers, the subsidies, the taxation regime and so on, to favour the more benign forms of energy and those that will in the long run be cheapest. So renewable energy is something that we pay a premium for at the moment. We pay a little bit extra on our bills to support and subsidise the renewable energy industry, but that's done so, and it's something we're happy to be supportive of, because in the long run it avoids a lot of environmental damage, but also it secures the most cheap sources of energy in the future.
Isn't the fact of the matter, Martin Summers, that we are making so much, the government is anyway, out of taxing energy and fuel, they actually want us to use as much as possible?
Well, it's back to do with the price elasticity of demand for energy, actually. Interestingly, years ago I went to a seminar where people had shown that if you raised the tax on energy and then created a national citizen's income with the results, what would happen, it was a guy who worked in the Treasury who put this forward, and it was very interesting because the national citizen's income led to a much better redistribution of resources, lots of nice redistribution effects, protected the poorest and so on. But what it didn't do was reduce energy consumption, because the price elasticity of demand for energy is so low or high. I can't remember which way round it is. The point is that because of the infrastructure of cars and so on and railways and so on and so forth, we you can't actually reduce very easily by price signals the amount of energy that people use, which is why you then use planning with what you were talking about, with using the levers there.
You might say the same for something like food, or you know, the basic things that you need to buy.
But when you need to keep warm, if you've got a gas heater in your room, it's going to be gas because that's the only thing you've got, and it's to do with the infrastructure that you've got and how quickly you can change it. But I think ultimately the real challenge is to reduce energy consumption. It's not, we can't go on consuming the Earth's resources at the rate in which we have. And the technology of actually reducing energy consumption is not even that complicated. We know what to do. We've just got to do it. And we've got to have a will to do it. And that's what's been lacking.
Mike, is it going to happen?
Well, I'd agree with what Martin says, is that the barriers aren't technical, they're political and to a degree social as well.
Aren't they economic? Yeah. The government can't afford to say, actually, we would like next year only to sell half as much petrol, can they?
Well, no, they can't change course in that respect overnight, which is why we originally had something called the fuel duty escalator, which was a sort of graduated rise year on year, so that it wasn't a sudden change. Nevertheless, I think the future of energy demand, really, there's only one way that we can afford for it to go, and that's to reduce demand. And it has been happening. We have been actually consuming less energy overall as across Europe over the last few years.
Isn't that a sign of economic slowdown? Yeah.
No, it's more than that, actually. It's reduced by considerably more than GDP has. So we're becoming a less energy intensive economy. We're generating the same amount of economic activity at the cost of less energy. But I mean, there are things that now that are coming in. I mentioned solar power, another new technology that people perhaps are not so very well aware of is what's called the LED light, and these will provide the kind of illumination that we need to be able to install street lights, have the lights on in this studio and so on, at a fraction of the energy that conventional, even low energy light bulbs.
What about an LED car or an LED gas fire?
Technical advances again there. I mean, we're looking at much more efficient lightweight batteries being a potential already. I think that the electric bike is beginning to make something of a real inroad into the transport system in Bristol. It might be some time before the electric car follows. But, there are undoubtedly, very interesting and promising technological solutions that are now beginning to break through to the extent that they're disrupting the existing model of how energy is bought and sold and consumed in this country. So okay. The model of the big six energy companies in a way is broken. They're very worried by what's happening in Germany, and I think they're going to get increasingly worried by what's happening here.
I mean, one of the great simplest solutions has always seemed to me, stick solar panels on your roof. That was something which the Labour Party in the last government pre-2010 really went for in a big way and had big subsidies for people to do that. What's the current situation? Are there any subsidies still available for people to actually get these panels on their roof? That to me is just a, everybody should, if they can, be generating some of their own power.
Yep, well, that's I'm glad you mentioned that, Tony. There's quite exciting developments here because actually those payback for people generating their own electricity off their own roofs, called the feed-in tariff, that still exists. It's at a lower rate than it was, but the cost of the solar panels and installing them has come down to such an extent that it still makes economic sense for a lot of householders and a lot of businesses to do it. But there are barriers and people don't necessarily know what's the quickest and most reliable and easiest way of doing it. But there's a big project being launched over the course of the next year by Bristol City Council. There's the Warm Up Bristol campaign, which is already going, which is largely about people being able to improve their energy, the warmth of their houses, the energy efficiency standard of everybody's house. But also in tandem with that, we're looking at major installations of solar power on publicly owned buildings, on houses, on private rented houses as well. And so we hopefully are at the stage where we're looking at Bristol City Council in partnership with solar installers and local energy cooperatives, which are run and owned by local people, being able to roll out a lot of solar installations over the city in the next few years.
There must be an election in the offing.
Anyway, but it's quite Mike, independent from the electoral cycle, as it happens.
Okay. What about your meeting? Just remind us again when it's happening tomorrow and who's going to be there.
Yes, thanks. So it's a cross-party panel. We've got three MPs, an MEP, and other experts debating the TTIP, investment, trade and investment protocol. It's happening. Doors open at 3, but the main meeting is happening between 4 and 6, and it's in the Wills Memorial Hall, which is possibly the most conspicuous building in Bristol, that big tower at the top of Park Street. So come along there for between 3 and 4, and hopefully we'll squeeze you in.
Okay, Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
A more modern MI6. There we go. I'm proud to hand over the reins of a more modern MI6, says C. This is in The Guardian last Sunday. Sorry about that. It takes special people, staff and secret agents to penetrate terrorist organisations and hostile powers. Leading them has been a privilege. There are few leadership challenges in public services that can compare. I'm proud to hand over a much more modern service to my successor. That's Sir John Sawyers, as he was reflecting on the weekend as he ended his tenure as C, the chief of MI6, after 5 turbulent years in which Britain's security agencies have had to confront new threats and the rebirth of ones from the past. Now, I'm going to be a bit cheeky because I think these people are the permanent government. They don't really get elected. They just chug along and they're selected by the people we elect. The Intelligence and Security Committee is stuffed with people who are pro the arms industry, the arms business, and they don't really seem to give a fig for the rest of us, Martin. So what are your thoughts about the role of MI6 these days?
I think, I'm afraid, my view is that all of these intelligence organisations are going to have to be dismantled completely and rebuilt from the bottom on a different basis. I'm afraid MI6 has got a reputation for being involved in terrorist activity, and I'm being very precise here. If people are interested to know about MI6's terrorist activities, they should just simply do a search for Gladio, GLADIO. The Gladio networks, which were run by MI6 and the CIA in Western Europe from the 1940s onwards, were definitely involved in terrorist activities in a number of European countries, particularly Italy, Belgium, and Germany. And these things have never been punished. This includes the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980. And we know this because of investigations by the Italian police force and parliamentary investigations in both Italy and Belgium inside the EU and Switzerland outside the EU. Now, in other words, MI6 I'm afraid. I mean, MI6, for example, were the lead agency in Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, which was basically the plan to get jihadis from Libya, from elsewhere in the Middle East, and train them, trained by British special forces, then infiltrated into Afghanistan to fight the Red Army. The MI6 was the lead agency in Operation Cyclone, the biggest undercover operation in history. And that's why, at one stage, the French secret services referred to London as Londonistan, because all of the jihadi groups were based in London, because they were being run by MI6. Now, MI6 liked to trade on the image that they have from things like the James Bond films. The reality is that they work closely with the CIA, who are absolutely documented terrorists and drug runners. And MI6, I'm afraid, are part of that structure. And ultimately, the civilian police force in Western Europe and elsewhere will have to dismantle these terrorist networks, which are part of the state.
Now, you mention also the CIA there in conjunction with MI6 running Gladio. These do seem to be probably the two most disreputable of all the global intelligence services, really, and actually quite proficient in undermining their political controllers, or people who are supposed to be completely controlling them, and also taking a lot of their funding from trading internationally in hard drugs as well. So let's go now to have a listen to the maker of the Lockerbie film, what we were talking about last week. We have a bit of a sort of running theme on Libya here. Libya seems to keep popping into the headlines again. But this Lockerbie film was really looking at the case that was made up against Libya, because it's quite clear, anyone that actually studies it, that Libya was not involved whatsoever in the Lockerbie bombing. And we heard last week, didn't we, that it was a break-in at Heathrow Airport the night before the Libyan plane took off, an unexplained one, which was never which was actually kept secret, kept away from the trial and the trial process, and certainly indicates that the Lockerbie bomb was actually put on the plane in Heathrow rather than in Malta, as the intelligence services and much of the press were telling us. Anyway, so let's go now to have a listen to Alan Frankovich, who was the maker of that film, The Maltese Double Cross.
He also made a film about Gladio.
Was shown on Channel 4, did he? He made a film, okay, yes.
Yes, he
made
a film very important later, film about Gladio, yes. He was on BBC Two in 1993. This film about Lockerbie is a specific incident, but the film about the series of films on Time Watch on BBC Two about Gladio really are essential watching for people who want to understand what our intelligence services really get up to.
Okay, so let's hear now from Alan Frankovich, and he was interviewed by a news magazine, a video news magazine in the late 1980s, called the Alternative Views video news magazine. So here's Alan Frankovich, the maker of the Lockerbie Maltese Double Cross Dispatches documentary now.
Consistently over a 30-year period of time, that they had nothing to show to do. Consistently over a 30-year period of time. Essentially,
I'm very sorry. Due to our problems with the CD players and things here, I'll have to just try and start that again.
And to show consistently over a 30-year period of time that they had nothing to do with national security. Essentially, they had a lot to do with justifying these operations, whether they're against Chile or Guatemala or Angola or. In European context, they had a lot to do with intervening in the internal affairs of a whole series.
He's talking about the CIA here, intervening in U.S. politics.
What the President of the United States wanted these countries to do. These kinds of activities are not something which just happened in moments of crisis. They go on every day in every country of the world. And they're the official but secret foreign policy of this country. And they're done specifically on presidential orders. And what will happen in 1974 and 1975, and I believe it happened primarily because one of the political parties, in the form of Richard Nixon, started using the same agency inside this country, not against dissidents, mind you, because I think against a major political party. And therefore, when that starts happening, you have to tell your guys, look, this far and no further. And you start investigating them, you have to make a real investigation, because they know all kinds of secrets, they know where all the bodies are buried. And therefore, to rein them in, you have to investigate them. But the conclusions, I knew in 1974, 75, they would never conclude that these were official government operations, that American presidents had ordered them, because the very nature of the CIA is to conduct these operations in secret, in such a way that if the CIA is caught, they take the responsibility themselves, and the President of the United States is protected.
Is that why they said that the CIA was a rogue elephant out of
exactly.
control?
Exactly, that was the conclusion. And if you look, for instance, if you look at the CIA, the assassinations the CIA claims they planned but never executed, you will find in the several cases the Church Committee went into, the Lumumba assassination, the assassination of the Commander-in-Chief of the Chilean Army, that a few days before these people are bumped off, a cable will go out saying, don't do it, guys, and nevertheless it goes ahead. And this is, again, standard CIA operating procedure. These operations are done to preserve the cover, and so that the United States then can take a moral position while eliminating someone that they consider to be an obstacle to what they want to accomplish.
So, Alan, it seems kind of contradictory that the CIA is secret, the people are secret, and yet in your documentary you have interviews with all of these high CIA officials and you were able to talk to so many people. Why is this?
Because the CIA, they have a kind of false openness. You see, a lot of what they do, for instance, in overseas posts, is they talk to the press, they manipulate the press. I would say that if you took a percentage of their operations, you would find that a great percentage-wise really have to deal with getting out their line through the media. Because if they accomplish that, in a sense, they control the way you see a situation. They control the way you think about a situation. So they have an ability, really, and they feel very much at ease with press and media. God knows the number of books which have been written by former CIA people to take a pro-CIA position. And it's only recently that there are some people like John Stockwell, Philip Agee, and a couple of other people who have really decided, well, if the pro-CIA people are writing books, why don't we write books? But we'll really go into the nature of some of these operations.
Alan Frankovic there, the documentary maker that died in the mid-1990s in suspicious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall. Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, he's talking there about, particularly about the influence that the CIA seemed to have in the press. And we heard, didn't we, from the former MI5 officer Annie Machon several years ago about the security services having a spy in every newsroom. It seems that they're almost obsessed by the media.
Well, contrary to what people might think, spies don't go around trying to find out secrets. They spend most of their time telling lies and making sure that those lies are believed. And therefore, of course, having your cat's paws in the media is an absolutely essential part of that. There's a German journalist who's been all over the media over the last few weeks saying that he was paid by the CIA to put out disinformation that they wanted people to believe. You'd be naive to believe that that's not what's going on. It certainly is what's going on. When we talked about Ukraine earlier, the manipulation of the news feed about Ukraine has clearly been carried out by Western intelligence services who want a certain kind of narrative to be embedded in people's minds. But of course, with modern technology and the internet, this is becoming an increasingly precarious exercise from their point of view.
Now, the accusation by the Americans is that actually the MI6 are the kind of lead agency in a lot of this, and the other way around. The Brits always accuse the Americans, saying, well, actually, I mean, America's so dominant here in Britain, militarily, economically, has been ever since the Second World War, that the Americans are in the driving seat. So who really is, if any of them?
Well, it would be hard to say, and even those who are involved probably don't know who's really in the driving seat, but it's certainly the case. MI6 like to present themselves as being gentlemanly and, working within the rules and the rule of law. The CIA, pretty much well known around the world as being swashbuckling cowboys. But I'm afraid I don't buy into that. The Operation Cyclone, which was covered, a film was made about it called Charlie Wilson's War, with Tom Hanks as the Senator Charlie Wilson. It was a Hollywood film, but it was largely accurate. What wasn't accurate in that film was that MI6 were given they were the lead agency for creating the International Islamic Brigade that eventually became Al-Qaeda. And of course, people say, well, that's just history. I'll say, no, it isn't, because all of the jihadis from all over the world who are fighting inside Syria have been helped by NATO intelligence services and have been trained by NATO personnel. probably including people like Ben Griffin, who we didn't talk about this earlier, but it's quite likely the British SAS are involved in training these jihadis who have been fighting inside Syria. And at the same time, of course, you then say, oh, look at all these terrible jihadis inside Syria, we need more powers to control what they're up to. Well, in actual fact, the way to control what they're up to is stop funding, arming and training them, which means people inside the structure, people like C, who's just resigned, these people should probably be in prison if we're serious about stopping international terrorism.
But what about the links, though, between the super rich and the these intelligence services? Because it does seem that what they're doing is they're operating really almost like not in the interests of the national security. So they in themselves could be a threat to national security. They're always going on about, oh, we're working to make sure we're keeping national security. But aren't they the biggest threat to it?
They are a threat to national security. I think there's no doubt about that. Fernando Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about all of this called The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, which came out in Italy in 2012. And he was quite clear that the source of terrorism in Western Europe is the Bilderberg Group. He spoke to the press in Italy and said, well, it's the Bilderberg Group who are behind all the terrorism. The Bilderberg Group is stacked with government ministers and the super wealthy. They are the terrorists. The jihadis are puppets.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. On Monday's sister show Dialect at 11 a.m, you can hear more from me. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was the councillor for Horfield, Ollie. And I can't even remember his second
Ollie
name,
Mead.
I'm afraid. Ollie Mead. You can follow us online at thisweek.org.uk with links from this show to many of our items. And you can follow me on Twitter at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time, 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down. And also, of course, just a reminder that the Merchant Venturers are meeting for their Charter Day service at 11 a.m. on Monday in Bristol Cathedral. And I'll leave you with a clip from Oh, What a Lovely War. Have a happy Remembrance Sunday.
The choir will now sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus as we offer a silent prayer for success in tomorrow's onslaught. Amen.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the Chancellor's claiming